Comedy in a few moments here on Radio 4 as Matt Ford convenes his focus group.
The Westminster Hour on BBC Radio 4. Day-to-day political reporting rattles along at a giddy pace, and the Westminster Hour is a space to reflect and think, where you'll hear candid but convivial conversation between politicians, journalists and experts, people with real insight on the issues and choices facing the country. It's a Sunday night, of course, and we want that vibe in the studio. A more relaxed evening cocktail of debate and ideas with, I hope, a slug of wit and wisdom in the mix too. The Westminster Hour with me, Ben Wright, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Sunday nights at 10.
And now on Radio 4...
Thank you. Hello and welcome to the Matt Ford Focus Group, the weekly comedy show where we examine the political landscape through one particular theme or concept to help make sense of it. I'm your host, Matt Ford, and this week we're looking at the world through the lens of political empathy. And I just want to make this clear at the start. I really feel your pain on this subject. I really do. I think that just sounded insincere. It wasn't meant to sound that bad. Now, many people think that empathy and politics go together like men and women at a Taliban wedding. They just don't mix. Yet most of us want our politicians to display empathy. After all, nobody likes a sociopath. There's a very good reason Nick Clegg lost his seat. Now, even Nigel Farage says he has empathy. In fact, he smokes about 20 empathy a day. However, some people dispute the value of empathy in politics. Former non-weirdo Elon Musk recently said, "The fundamental weakness of Western civilization is empathy." Now, I know, watching Elon Musk talk about empathy is about as comfortable as watching Dawn French talk about Gaza. It's not their specialist subject. But is our empathy often misplaced, and can it lead to serious miscalculations? Given foreign care workers the right to bring their families to the UK, giving relatively well-off pensioners their winter fuel payment back, giving Ed Miliband a job in cabinet. Potentially terrible decisions we will live to regret for decades to come. So my guests tonight are two politicians and a journalist, all three of whom will never be prime minister.
That was empathy from the audience, thank you.
Author and host of the BBC's Strong Message Here, Helen Lewis, former Tories chair and member of the House of Lords, Baroness Varsey, and leader of the Liberal Democrats, Sir Ed Davey. Ed, you're known for being an unpaid carer looking after a very vulnerable individual. What's it like working with Tim Farron?
Well, he's really big on sewage. And when I fell off that paddleboard in Windermere, he was there to help me.
He's a good man. Helen, you've recently written a book about geniuses and the issues they face. So, do you empathise with my struggles?
Oh, it's very moving. Yeah, I mean, it's not a pro-genius book. I would warn you about that. Quite often when you call someone a genius, it's a prelude to them going a bit mad. And in your case, luckily, you've swerved that.
I've gone mad first. I've cut out the genius bit. Saida, as a Conservative, does empathy come naturally to you, or do you need to take a supplement?
Well, I'm big on supplements. But I'm a non-affiliated Conservative, which is kind of my way of having a crisis. It's about saying that I know that I shouldn't be here. I know this is a toxic relationship, but I kind of feel like I've been in it so long and I've invested so much in it that I might just kind of hang around for the sake of the kids.
That is very much the I didn't inhale of Toryism. So, yeah.
OK, let's analyse the principle of empathy through the issue of asylum. Britain likes to think of itself as a safe haven for refugees, from the Huguenots to the Vietnamese boat people to highly organised criminal gangs trafficking migrants into the black economy. It's part of who we are. But should there be a limit to our empathy when it comes to asylum? Kemi Badenoch wants anyone arriving here illegally to be deported. Legal experts have concluded that that will never happen because it would require Kemi Badenoch to become Prime Minister. Ultimately, Badenoch wants to review the European Convention on Human Rights. And when she says review, she wants to review it in the same way that the RAF reviewed Dresden. But it's not just the Conservatives. Yvette Cooper is looking at ways of housing failed asylum seekers in so-called return hubs, possibly in the Balkans. Now, you may remember Labour were against sending migrants to Rwanda, accusing the Tories of going too far. Turns out they just meant it was too far geographically and that Bosnia was just far away enough. So, Helen, I think it's fair to say you're a hard-nosed centrist. Might even you sometimes fall into the trap of having too much empathy for people and assuming the best motives in everyone who comes here?
No. I think, I was just looking at the fact that Ed's book is called Why I Care, and I thought I could probably write the version that says Why I Don't Care. Just assume the worst of absolutely everybody at all times, and then you're never disappointed. But you're right, the idea of empathy has become really controversial. On the US right, there's this whole idea, have you heard this? Toxic empathy or suicidal empathy. The other thing is they also think empathy is for girls. I mean, that's the undertone that runs under a lot of it. It's like, but the thing is, women, they're empathetic, and therefore it must be bad. That's just how it works. So, yes, I'm bucking that stereotype by being extremely hard-nosed, Matt.
That is a good thing to know. Ed, would you like to see, and I realise it's a very direct question, but even as a liberal, would you like to see fewer asylum seekers?
Well, I think asylum seekers have a role to play, but we've got to make sure that they are genuine asylum seekers. In a bizarre way, I think the Conservatives are too empathetic to asylum seekers. Do you know what? They're the only ones who they don't want to work. So they want all of us to work and, you know, get off our backsides and work, but they won't allow asylum seekers to work. I think that would help with the hotel bill and help with the finances.
Is it hard for liberal people to almost accept that empathy must have its limits?
You know, I think it's a good thing, empathy. It doesn't mean you have to be soft. I've got a asylum seeker living with me. Well, she's from Ukraine, and she's amazing. I'm really impressed by how she and her family have adapted to a horrific situation. But
what, living with you? Or
yeah, well...
I was going to do the classic, has she not suffered enough? Yeah. And I thought, no, Helen, that's cheap. And then there you came in with the two-footed tackle, man.
Well, you know what? Yeah, if you talk to Ukrainians, they've got their own back on us, because some of them have said, you know, we can't find an NHS dentist anywhere, so we're going back to Ukraine.
Saida, do you think, in a way, our immediate empathy for people coming here in small boats, because we do feel sorry for them and we feel that we want to give them a better life here, in a way, that
who
empathy...
Does? Well, who does? I have yet to hear politicians say that. And, you know, sometimes we keep talking, don't we, about all these people that are coming in here and we're letting them in and it's unprecedented. And, yes, we have to have a managed asylum and immigration policy. But you know what we forget? That up to the First World War, masses of Europeans and about 19 million Brits, nearly 50% of our population at the time, were migrating to the global south and to the global east and to the global west. We're not being empathetic. You know, we're not out. The UN Convention on Refugees and our human rights kind of provisions aren't just because we're being nice people. It's a bit of justice.
These treaties, they were formed and signed in the wake of World War II, and the world has changed a lot since then.
You know what the biggest change is?
The internet.
No, the World War II, that as well, but I come from the north, we don't always have internet. The biggest change that happened at the point of World War II was that Europe stopped becoming a global migrant supplier and for the first time became an attractive place for migrants to come here.
I agree with you totally, but I also think there's a problem of not feeling that the rules are being followed. And this is where I think empathy comes in. I think because on the left, it's really hard to say something that sounds in any way anti-immigration. But there is a point that I don't like seeing people in boats because that means that they've paid really bad people to get in those boats. And I think, couldn't we have an asylum system that is tough but humane and treats everybody with dignity? But I think sometimes, don't you think that does get a bit muddied up with the idea that you can't say that you want any restrictions at all?
No, I don't. I, think we should have clear restrictions, but we should also say, I mean, when we have, for example, you know, I was Minister for Afghanistan for many years. We had people in Afghanistan who worked alongside our troops and worked alongside us. We took no responsibility for these people and we just left them there. So I find it really difficult to say that those people who are concerned about small boats arriving here, many of which are Afghans, by the way, if you don't put a proper legal system in place, we can't moan about the fact that people get here illegally.
I don't think we celebrate what asylum seekers who've come to this country in the past now contribute. I remember doing my advice surgery in Kingston one morning, and this guy came and he was an Iraqi asylum seeker. And he said, I've come to offer you help, Mr. Davey. And I thought, oh, great, you're going to deliver some leaflets for me. That'd be brilliant. But it turned out he was a vet. I mean, it was the middle of the foot and mouth disease. And he said, look, I've actually diagnosed foot and mouth in cattle back in Iraq, and I've vaccinated and treated it. I can help you. So I rang up the helpline, and I said, I've got a trained vet here. Where shall I send him? And he said, does he speak English? Is he a member of the Royal Society of Veterinary Surgeons? And I said, well, I mean, I don't think he is, because he's a asylum seeker, but could you tell me what pig, cow and sheep speaks English?
Helen, you've ended up being the most right-wing person
on
this panel.
Very exciting. Always dreamed of it. I tell you what, though, the people who really do not suffer from an overdose of empathy are the Trump administration on asylum, right? They posted a video of people to the sound of, like, clanking chains being put on a plane. There is a real relish in that system about not being empathetic. This is what I mean. Like, I think sometimes people can be afraid to have those conversations in Britain because they really want to be empathetic. But a significant proportion of Americans revel in this kind of overtly cruel style now in American politics. It's very weird.
I don't think that's true. I think it's very sad what you're saying. I think we got a lot of, what I think the word was empathy that you used. I've not heard it many times before, but I like the sound of it. It sounds a bit like sympathy, so I'm worried that it might be a bad word, but.
Definitely have more empathy than Trump has, because if they didn't, I mean, God, who would marry him? Come on. It took foreign women time and time again to take that man to bed, yeah? Proving once again that foreigners will do jobs that locals won't.
Ed, you've obviously got personal experience of small boats and swan-shaped paddlers. So maybe you can empathise more with those people.
Yeah, but, I mean, the Channel's probably cleaner than Windermere, but, you know, I think Saidi was absolutely right. We've got to think more globally about this. And, you know, isn't it bizarre that we're cutting international aid when actually that could be used as a way to persuade people not to come because they could stay in their own country?
But isn't, you know, we say working with international partners, doesn't that just mean we get other countries to take them, so that then we get less.
Well, as Saida said, we should have safe and legal routes for genuine asylum seekers. I think that is the right thing to do. We should be tough on those people who've got no right to be here, but I do think we should meet our international obligations.
OK, we asked our audience on this issue, what or who do we have too much empathy for in this country and why? And you said, people who call sauce Jew.
Is that not just the French?
Yes, it's a very sophisticated form of racism that we're getting from our Radio 4 crowd. Someone said, people who play music out loud on their phones on public transport.
Can I say this is my favourite Liberal Democrat policy in some time? I was just like, if Ed Davey tasers someone who's playing their phone on public transport, then he's going to be Prime Minister. I just feel it.
OK, let's analyse the theme of empathy through the government's decision to cut the international aid budget in order to fund more defence spending. In short, less love bombing, more carpet bombing. It is surprising how little outcry there's been about this. Are we now lacking empathy for the most in need? It can be harder to feel empathy for people who come from another world, don't speak your language and don't share your values, like fans of Millwall. Learn the language, boys. However, is this about something else? Has seeing the suffering of the people of Ukraine shifted our view that defence spending is a vital form of aid? We definitely empathise with the people of Ukraine. They're our European neighbours. Plus, we don't want Russia to come for us next. And, like the modern British male, Volodymyr Zelensky shares the same reluctance to shave or wear suits in the office. He's one of us. Saida, there has been incredibly little controversy surrounding the government's decision to cut international aid and divert that money to the defence budget. Do you think that's purely a consequence of what's happened in Ukraine?
No, I think it's just the way in which we've become more and more kind of selfish and inward-looking. And if you think about where we were during the coalition agreement, when we gave a commitment to make 0.7% of our general national income to be committed to aid, and we put that into legislation. By the way, we're breaking the law every time we do this, and we should be justifying why we're breaking the law.
We should deport ourselves.
But what is this? Well, wait for a Conservative government, they might just do it. But I think this is, I mean, welcome to empathetic Britain, right? Where we have now got to a point in British leadership in politics where feeding starving children in Gaza is too hard, but actually supplying arms to bomb them can be easily delivered. It's not just about handing out charities to some of the poorest in the world. It's about making sure that people have clean water. It's about making sure that if you give people an education, they've got something to live for and they can provide for their own futures. And I think it's very, very short-termist.
To be fair, we're not hypocrites when it comes to things like clean drinking water because we don't have that here. So we're just trying to spread our filthy drinking water around the globe. It's a great British value. Ed, do you think empathy for Ukraine demonstrates a tendency, whether we like it or not, that we do have more empathy for people that we feel look a bit more like us, i.e. white Europeans?
Well, I think that may well be true, and certainly we do have empathy for Ukrainians. If you go around villages and towns and cities, I've been delighted by how many Ukrainian flags are flown. But I have to pull you up, Matt, and some of us have opposed the cuts in international aid. We don't think that's the right way to fund extra defence spending. We need that extra defence spending, partly because of the way that Trump is behaving. You know, I don't know about you, but I think the idea that these frozen Russian assets haven't been confiscated and used to help Ukraine beat Putin, I think, why haven't they done that?
Helen, aren't people being a little bit unfair on what the government have done, really? Isn't it the reality that military support for Ukraine really is a form of aid?
I mean, it absolutely is. I mean, it's keeping a lot of people in Ukraine alive, which is, I think, you know, the basic point of international aid. I think one of the things that's really come to my mind all about all this is about empathy, is about how difficult it is to do journalism now in some of these places, right? We are just not getting pictures from Sudan, for example. We're not getting... Journalists are not allowed into Gaza. One of the ways that we curate empathy is by telling people's human-level stories, and we're just not getting those from some of the most dangerous places in the world. So it is quite difficult to foster empathy. I mean, on the defence budget, I'm going to recover my left-wing credentials by saying I think Keir Starmer should have turned around and said, I know I said I wasn't going to put taxes up, but that was before America elected a maniac. And I'm afraid if you want to not speak Russian, you're going to have to pay for it and put taxes up.
If you use international aid properly, it's about buying peace for the future. It's greater security for the future, as well as the right thing to do, taking people out of poverty. And I have to declare an instance. Originally, before going to politics, I was going to go into helping developing countries.
I was going to say the army.
No. Well, I'll come to MI6 later, actually. But I thought of going into aid, and I was going to do a MSc in agricultural economics at Kent University. But they weren't as desperate to have me as the Liberal Democrats were.
Do you ever sometimes just sort of look at a field longingly and think, that could have been me, I could have been having thoughts about that?
It was Theresa May, wasn't it? Let's say there's some sort of European rearmament plan. People in the Conservative Party, I mean, we remember before we left the EU and there were scare stories of a European army. Politically, would it be possible for Britain to take part in something like that?
I think we'd be in some sort of conundrum because on the one hand, obviously, we like to think we're the party of law and order and defence and therefore we want strong defences. We also don't want to tax anybody, so we don't want to pay any more money in getting those defences. And there's only so much you can take away from the international aid budget. Where next? If we're going to defend our country properly, then that includes, actually, I think, looking at the European Union and looking at ways in which we can have a Europe-wide thing.
One of the challenges we've got is to grow the armed forces. I don't know if people know this, but it's been shrunk and shrunk over recent decades. It's now the smallest British army since before the Napoleonic Wars, over 200
years ago. So we clearly got to grow the size of it. And to recruit people, we need to treat them better. We need to get them better housing. But part of attracting them back is to show that when they leave and they're veterans, that we treat them well.
When you were saying that the army's been the smallest it's been since the Napoleonic War, part of me did think, we don't do a lot of cavalry charges anymore, though, do we? Like, I can see that we maybe moved into... Do we not now need a kind of slightly different type of army? Like, you know, more people sort of hacking internets and fewer people with bayonets?
Well, I'm not on the bayonet side of the argument.
Okay, good.
Do you know, there's this whole bunch of people, you must know about this, Ed, where in Parliament, all parliamentarians get a chance to be a soldier. And parliamentarians love it, don't they? Because they get to dress up in a soldier's uniform and run around with, you know, kind of fancy-looking weapons for a while. And so I think if we are serious about defence, we should start by introducing national service for every parliamentarian.
I think we want the army to work. Sorry, don't...
Just sat around all day going, yeah. We asked our audience, which global supervillain do you most empathise with and why? Someone said, Kim Jong-un. He's got a whole country to choose from and the poor bloke can't even find a decent barber. And someone else said, the Penguin, because of global warming. Finally, if we're so empathetic as a society, how have we failed to deliver high-quality social care? Carers are like abattoir workers or Lee Anderson's press team. We're aware they exist, but we don't want to picture the often harrowing work they have to carry out. According to the last census, there were almost 6 million unpaid carers in the UK. So, is the state exploiting other people's empathy? The cold truth is, carers have been overlooked by successive governments because they're not a powerful political lobby. But could that change? What if they formed their own union, like Unite, but without the widespread pervasive fraud and corruption? And I really think a good acronym would help them. I'm the leader of the Confederation of Unpaid Nursing Technicians. And if you don't give us a decent pay rise, I will force you to keep saying our name in Parliament. I'd like to say it's great to see so many of our members here today. So, Ed, this is obviously an area you know well. Do you feel exploited? And I don't mean as leader of the Liberal Democrats.
I don't feel exploited because when you're looking after a loved one, actually the relationship can be fantastic. So, of course, there's tough sides of being a carer. And I'm not going to sugarcoat the pill. It can be really tough. I looked after my mum, who was terminally ill when I was a teenager. So my dad had died when I was 4, and she died when I was 15. And I, with my brothers and my nan and granda, looked after her, and we didn't have any external help. But I had a great relationship with my mum, even though it was tough. And then my nana and others, but nana got very close to my nana, and she looked after me, and then I looked after her. And now I look after my amazing son with my wife. And I'm not going to say any of those relationships were exploitative, because they were loving relationships, and I was very fortunate and in so many ways. But I know from talking to lots of carers and lots of constituents who are family carers that some people are exploited, and though they can get some positive things from their caring relationships, it can be really, really tough for them. And if we're going to sort out social care, and I think thereby the NHS, we have to start with family carers and make it a little bit easier for them. You know, to do that, yes, it means maybe a little more money to help them because they're not working often, sometimes not working enough, so they haven't got money coming in. Sometimes it's enabling them to manage work and caring. Sometimes it's giving them a little bit of a break. Sometimes it's giving them training. There's lots of things you can do which don't cost a lot. And just to sort of lighten the tone, I've written a book about it.
You've monetized it.
Yeah.
It's obviously such a highly emotive subject, and you've got so much personal experience of it. You know, so much of your life has been involved being a carer. But there must be moments of levity as well. Aren't there, Ed?
Well, yeah, the word that comes to mind at the moment for looking after John, which has some humour, is poo. I mean, I don't want to suggest that all care is about poo, because it really isn't, but with John, it can quite often be about poo. I've never said poo so often, and it's... I feel liberated. But sometimes you don't get there at the right time. And there are times, you know, when you're going swimming with them that can be particularly interesting. Oh, but I blame sewage pollution on the water companies.
Yeah, the poor old water companies are getting the blame. Imagine if it turned out to be the Davy family. I mean, you must... have to like anticipate what things you can and can't eat before you do things.
Oh, do you want the full lecture? No, but it's amazing. You know, seriously, when you're looking after someone who's got problems, incontinence and so on, you do have to plan ahead. You have to think really carefully. You have to talk to them and communicate with them really well. It's a really important part of caring.
It's great that we always say we want politicians to have a hinterland, and Ed Davies turns out to be poo.
Be the poo guy.
Yeah. I know, and incontinence, which, you know, welcome to the world of a menopausal woman.
Yes, is this triggering for you, Simon?
It's very triggering, especially because we didn't get a chance to use the loo before we came out. This is so true.
Never startle a menopausal lady, Matt. That's what we've learned here.
Saida, you know when we talk about difficult choices in politics, and care seems to be one of those things that politicians say, well, it's very difficult choices. In a way, are they just using empathy as a way to avoid making expensive decisions?
I think so. I mean, Ed was telling us before we came on set that since 1997, there have been something like 25 different reports on social care, you know, formally commissioned, informally, House of Lords Select Committee, Commons Select Committees. There's just been so many different reports. We know what the problem is, and we know how to fix it, and we kind of say all the nice things, and we particularly say them because we know old people vote, but we actually don't do anything about it. And in the end, we've got to be able to take some really tough decisions to say, is the care of not just older people, but people who need, you know, adult social care, all the rest of it, is the care of these people as essential as the NHS? And if it is, are we going to have the confidence to be able to fund it? And are we also going to say to people, and I know, you know, my Tory colleagues are going to throw their hands up in the air when they say this, but actually, if you are saving, you know, and you've done well, and you've got a house, and you've got assets, then what's the point of all of that if they can't be used to give you a dignified life at the end of life? And I know lots of people say, well, no, actually, you know, I want my house to go to my kids. Well, yeah, before I want my house to go to my kids, I want to be able to live my life in the most dignified way before I go.
It's a heck of a way for your kids to find out they're getting nothing.
Listen, they can come round and care for me then, can't they? They can either have the house or they can wipe my bottom.
We asked our audience, if you had to provide 24-hour round-the-clock care for one politician, who would it be and why? Someone said, Angela Rayner. I would take her to the pub and let the fun end you. Someone else said, Jacob Rees-Mogg, because his nanny is long overdue a holiday. And someone else said, that bloke from the Lib Dems, as I'd appreciate the free entry to various sports and outdoor activities in the run-up to the election. So there you go, Ed. What you put out into the universe comes back. People are prepared to care for you. Well, that concludes this session of the Matt Ford Focus Group. Huge thanks to my panel, Saida Varsi, Ed Davey and Helen Lewis. What better way to sum up empathy than with the words of renowned film critic Roger Ebert, who once said, empathy is the most essential quality of civilization. No, it's not. It's not holding your knife like a pencil. Thanks for listening. Goodbye. The Matt Ford Focus Group was written and hosted by me, Matt Ford, with additional material from Carl Minns, Jason Hazley, and Richard Garvin. It was produced by Richard Garvin and is an Avalon production for BBC Radio 4.
And Matt will be gathering his next focus group at the same time next Wednesday. Rachel White-Read, she was the first woman to win the Turner Prize back in 1993, and she's discussing her new art show at Goodwood. That is in Front Row Live from Edinburgh tonight at 7:15 after the Archers. But someone is calling us right now.
This is BBC Radio 4. Please leave a message after the pips.
Hello, it is your monarch here with a small request. I'm soon to have President Trump over to the palace for a slap-up banquet of chlorinated chicken. One was wondering if you might have an impersonator to stand in for one on that night. That Mike Yarwood fellow, perhaps. Or maybe one of those dead ringers. No, they can't, can they? They're busy doing their own show. Oh well, Camilla and I will just have to hide behind the sofa like when certain members of the family call round.
A new series of Dead Ringers starts on Radio